As I spoke to a little bit earlier, the theme or the kind of arc of these 3 days or the evening in 2 days has been about stepping onto the path or beginning the practice, and today about staying or sustaining the practice, and then tomorrow we'll be talking a little bit about just being on the practice. So I bought into play last night a bit about taking refuge, which is one of the places of beginning, and how on retreat we take refuge, residential retreat, we take refuge, we say the precepts. So we didn't do any of that because this is non-residential and we're all living our lives outside of here as we come and go. And maybe throughout the day also have to be engaged with family members or other responsibilities that we had. However, one of the propositions or one of the invitations I extended to you was to actually do some contemplating and some investigation as to whether you might be interested, if you're not already doing so, taking refuge and using the precepts as a guideline just in terms of a way to live. You know, so that there starts to become a softening or a joining of this way that we are, where we are practicing and then we're living, as opposed to living being the practice. So it's something to think about. And part of what's so useful about the precepts, and they are guidelines, you know, they're not edicts or like the commandments and some of the other religious and spiritual traditions, but they're actually suggested guidelines that have been tried and found true in terms of a way to set ourselves up such that we live our lives from a place of clarity and not creating continual stress for ourselves in relationship to what we might bring into existence through unwise or wrong view. So I know you all are doing work with the Eightfold Path, and I believe Tawari told me that you all started it last week or in recent days. And the first component, and it's not so much linear, I use these words for communication, but one of the things that's really, really I appreciate about the Dharma, and which is really, really true, is that there really is no hierarchy or value of one component of it being more valuable than another, that it's really more like a, I forget what it's called, but like a holograph where you can enter in at any point or engage with any aspect or component of the practice and support oneself with moving forward in terms of deepening and enriching understanding and well-being in one's life. But there is this component of the Eightfold Path, which is made up of right action, right speech, and right livelihood, called, or the terminology used to look at that being that of ethical conduct. And ethical conduct, or sila in Pali, is also where the precepts exist in terms of these guidelines. I'm going to do something. So I'm going to read you the precepts and then I'm going to say something about that. So the first one is I undertake the training to refrain from killing. And I prefer actually the usage of the word I undertake the training to refrain from taking life. Because killing, that is certainly one aspect of harm or not in right action, but we can actually kill or take life from people, from beings, from things, even in our mind. There doesn't necessarily have to be an action behind it, but a thought or a feeling that's directed towards someone that causes harm. You know, some of us have come from places or know people that live in situations where they're constantly being psychologically or emotionally battered. That's a way of taking life. You know, so I invite you to expand the way you think about that particular precept. And it can be in a flash, you know, it can be in a flash. I can I won't repeat it because it's not wise speech, but I can hear my mind when someone cuts me off every now and then when I'm driving. Before I even have the ability to change my mind, there it is. I have literally totally cursed that person out. Not so wise, and certainly not in alignment with the practice that I'm attempting to engage with. And kind of the underpinning or the intervening in working with this precept, I undertake the training to refrain from taking life. On the other side, you can take the vow to cultivate compassion towards all beings. And I know oftentimes when that kind of situation shows up that I just described for myself when I'm in the car, immediately after that happens, I'll say to myself, now you know that ain't right, and offer myself some compassion and understanding around my humanness. But to recognize it, that's where the practice comes, because there's loads of people out there that are doing that and they're not even aware that's what they're doing and they're causing harm energetically. The second precept, I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. So there's all subtle levels of that. You know, of course, there's stealing and all of that kind of thing. But another way that we can take what is not freely given, especially in relationship, is like taking up too much space in a relationship or not allowing enough space for who we may be in relationship with, whether that be a partner or a child, a pet, not paying enough attention to a pet. So again, inviting you to expand. I know you've heard these precepts time and time again, and just inviting you to actually sit with them for a bit and really explore what your relationship, the kind of underpinning or intervention is not the right word, but the moving away from doing harm by undertaking the training to not take what is freely given is to vow to practice generosity. Wow, there's something really available in one's life when that be the come from place, the place of generosity. Generosity of heart, generosity of time, generosity of understanding, generosity of companionship, all kinds of ways that we get to be generous. In the third precept, I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. You know, that really doesn't take a lot of investigation other than understanding. And I'm sure we've all had this experience, whether in relationship to this particular precept or any of the others, of how our minds can make some action seemingly all right. And that actually being a place of practice to get into the more subtle layers of how unskillful means can just pop in and enter into if it's something that we want or something that we want to justify in terms of some behavior or engagement that we take up. And the antidote, that's the word I was looking for before, the antidote to undertaking the training to refrain from sexual harm is to cultivate responsibility. You know, to cultivate responsibility in how we live our lives, how we understand our lives and others, how we perceive things, to take the vow to cultivate responsibility. And then the fourth precept is undertaking the training to refrain from harmful speech. And remember, with harmful speech, at times it's not just the words one might be saying, but the tone or the energy. Or being stuck on wanting to be right and engaging all kinds of conversation around proving your point. Many ways, again, to understand and not take these precepts just at the face value of what they're saying, but really to explore how they may be playing out in how you engage with yourself and how you engage with others, and create perhaps or perpetuate stress and non-well-being. And then the last precept that there's five. When we're on retreat, oftentimes there's eight that are offered, and then I don't know the number, but if you're a monastic, there are hundreds. So the fifth one for us is, I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. So that's important. Intoxication, which leads to carelessness. Of course, the way I'm reading that and the way I would understand it is, if I'm intoxicated, it's going to lead to carelessness. So I don't think this is really actually addressing the one glass of wine one might have, or the one beer, if that's your thing. You know, some of us decide not to even engage, but I think the important word here is intoxication. The antidote to that is, I vow to ingest items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. Well, that's an interesting one. I'm not going to go there, but thinking about the current status of marijuana in our country, some people would interpret peace, well-being, and joy as the outcome of the use of that particular ingestion. So sila, or ethical conduct, the right action, the right speech, the right livelihood, are the three of the factors of the Eightfold Path. And it's this ethical conduct that we get to engage with and provide a place to live from, which promotes, if we're engaged that way, really the outcome is promoting a happy and harmonious life. Like, it's a cause and effect kind of thing. So the place to, you know, when we come into this practice, and that's why I'm presenting this morning in terms of one of the tools. There's many tools, it's not just one, but one of the tools that can be really useful and really helpful in attempting to stay on the path, especially in the hard places. Because, you know, when we begin this practice and even move into it, I was speaking with one of our Sangha this morning, and they were commenting about the length of time that it took for them to really get it in their bones in terms of the practice. And I know for myself, who's been practicing for about 25 years or so, that it took quite a bit of time where it became like breathing. And I didn't even have to think about, really, because it became so integrated in who I was and how I was being. But when we begin on this path, remember, we're cleaning up stuff we set in motion way long time ago. And I'm not even talking about whether one believes or attests to previous lives. I'm talking about in this life. That before that moment of awakening, before that moment of being called to engage with this practice, whether on subtle or gross levels, all of us have wreaked havoc, either for ourselves or for others. Rahula says that there is no spiritual development that is fully possible without a moral basis. Another component of the perfected practice, and I'm not saying perfection, but the perfected practice, is to have highly developed these two qualities of compassion, or karuna, and wisdom, panya. And wisdom is where ethical conduct exists within the Eightfold Path, and you all will be learning more about that. But the heart qualities of compassion, represented through the energies of love, charity, kindness, tolerance, and other such noble qualities on the emotional side, are equally as important as the wisdom, standing for the intellectual side or qualities of the mind. For freedom and perfection, we must develop both. And I know that in this practice that, in this practice in the West, the way Western Vipassana has been emphasized over the course of time since it was introduced here by many of the people that are on that chest over there that have come to speak to you. There's been an emphasis on the development of the mind, the development of the cognitive, the development of the intellectual, and maybe not so much the heart. For those of us, you know, it's a lot more challenging, not just in our world, not meaning our world, the Vipassana world, not just in the Vipassana world, but in this culture and society called the United States. It's very challenging to sustain cultivation of heart. All the structures are designed against that. Competition, money gaining, acquisition of stuff, capitalism, differences. Our whole structure is inclined towards not supporting the cultivation of heart qualities. And I'm mentioning one of them here, and I'm going to work a little bit with you all with just the loving kindness this morning. But there's four of them, you know. There's loving kindness or metta, there's karuna or compassion, there's mudita or sympathetic joy, and there's upekkha or equanimity. And again, going back to what I said, there's no level of a hierarchy within those four Brahma Viharas. They're all equally important to cultivate. And one of the things that I took on personally over these last few years as things have escalated in terms of societal and cultural distress and disease is the practice of equanimity and balance. But I bring loving kindness forward this morning because it's kind of the metta is kind of the wellspring or the soil in which the cultivation of mindfulness and the cultivation of the other Brahma Viharas begins. So it's kind of like if we get the soil right, like if we get all the nutrients in and we're watering and all of that, then everything naturally and organically evolves from there in a good enough way. So some thought to the precepts and actually engaging them in everyday living and not just when there's a day long or a weekend or even a residential that you're attending. It actually, over time, with practice, softens and enlivens one's whole life. And they're not too bad. It's only five of them, you know. Most of us grew up with 10 or 20. All right, so a few words about metta. You know, I think of this practice, not just the practice of the Brahma Viharas, but the all of our practice. I really think of it like we're learning the foundational components such that we can then create lives where we riff and we know exactly what to bring in any moment of distress and or well-being. Kind of like a jazz piece, you know, one of the things about the really good jazz musicians, except for those who are just gifted and born that way, is you learn the foundations and then you let it all drop away and you go for it. And so that's the game we're engaged with here in terms of the practice. The ultimate goal is to not to have a perfected practice. The ultimate goal is to have a life of joy and well-being and connection and engagement with others, you know, not just freedom for ourselves. So loving kindness as the Brahma Vihara that I'd like to highlight in this moment, you know, I think most people, if not all, have done some Brahma Vihara practice, some metta practice. So one of the things that I'd like to just bring forward is that, again, This is a very cognitive-oriented culture, and so words and language are very highly valued and practiced. And so when doing metta practice or doing Brahma-Vihara practice, one of the ways that we can generate that energy and that energetic kind of stance in our bodies, hearts, and minds is through the use of using phrases to generate that. And that's all well and good. That's great. There's nothing wrong with that. And certainly, you've probably been told that even in terms of using the classic phrases, if they don't quite work for you, that there's a freedom that you have to bring the phrases into alignment with what feels natural for you. And for some of us, that may even mean saying the phrases in another language, depending on what your heart language is or what your emotional language is. So that's one way. But there's also this way that we can generate memory, memory that comes of a time or place or a person where we felt this energetic quality of the heart, of loving kindness, of friendliness, of goodwill. So that's another way that you can generate it. Then there's another way where we can use creative imagination. So it may not be a memory, something that we actually experienced or some actual engagement, but that we can create images visually as well as body-wise that generate, again, that quality of loving kindness, that quality of compassion, that quality of sympathetic joy, that quality of equanimity. And then lastly, and there may be other ways too, I'm not saying that this is a finite list, but they're just some things that I've learned and that I've thought about. There's the body memory. So as opposed to the cognitive memory, there's the body memory of how it feels in the body to be home, how it feels in the body to be relaxed, how it feels in the body to be well, and being able to generate from that place this practice of the Brahma Viharas. It may be kind of hokey to some people, but it's kind of really in front of me here in the spring in Seattle, because it's really spring here. I don't know what's going to happen at home in New York, because yesterday was 85 degrees, so I don't know how the plants and the flowers and everybody's going to do with that. But here, because there's this kind of gradual warming in these days, all of the, like the magnolia tree, the blossom, it's like it's snowing flowers. And so one of the visuals that I use when I try to engage, or when I engage with the Brahma Viharas to generate feelings, is that I actually picture that. It's like, oh, that's my visualization, like flowers falling down around me, and how that generate, what feeling that generates in my body, and what that visual ticks off. So whatever does you. So the practice of metta is an incremental practice, and the phrases that we use are just guides. It's really more about the heart space, or that felt place that creates the conditions for freedom to emerge. This practice and the power of loving kindness and all the Brahma Viharas in general create the conditions of understanding for the knowing of non-separation. It really supports and grows that understanding or that awareness. The practice of loving kindness builds the foundation of understanding that then lays out the conditions for calmness, clarity of mind and heart, and wisdom. The Buddha, it is said, described the spiritual path that leads to freedom as the liberation of the heart, which is love. And he taught a systematic, integrated path that moves the heart out of isolating contraction and into true connection. And again, you know, we're really swimming against the stream. And it's not something that hasn't been present before. Something's happened over the millenniums that has taken us away, particularly in the West, from the real gift and availability of immediate freedom through the true knowledge of who we are and being engaged with all beings. The indigenous community actually even has a saying that is used, all my relations. You know, they didn't forget that everything is connected, that all beings need to be well. Or as I said last night, none of us can be fully free. The Buddha also taught to abandon the unskillful, which brings harm and suffering, and cultivate the good, as this brings benefit and happiness. We really do an urban dharma, you know. It's like, who would have imagined in Seattle? I thought at home, yeah, but... Abandoning or putting down unskillful states and habits that cause suffering will not happen if generated by a desire to get rid of these states or to have it be another way. Nor can it happen out of fear or contempt. Abandoning the unskillful is not accomplished by angrily pushing away or shoving away our habits of separation. Basically talking about aversion here. We are able to transform these habits and mind states as we come to truly know and love ourselves and all beings, therefore allowing the light by which we can see and bear witness to the burdens and suffering that come from following states of mind like anger, fear, grasping, states that cause harm to ourselves and others. It's kind of even in the fabric, I kind of alluded to this a few minutes ago, it's kind of even in the fabric of this nation. Yes, you know, there is an aspect or component to this country, which was created as a safe haven for some people. But by virtue of that group of people coming here for a safe haven caused a lot of harm to a lot of other people that were already here. So I guess fundamentally, I'm right in that in the foundational creation of this country, the kind of fabric is based on greed, aversion, and delusion. And so to engage with this practice and to really roll it out is to actually go against the grain of what the underpinnings of this culture have been around. So we're talking about a cultural transformation, actually. As we cultivate our hearts and minds to incline towards awareness and clear seeing, understanding and wisdom reveal to us with vision and acumen the wise way of the road to journey on through this precious human life. So as I grow and understand and get feedback, which I'm really happy about, I'm going to read a story. It's just a short little story about the two wolves. One evening, an old grandfather told his grandson about a battle that goes on inside people. He said, "My son, the battle is between two wolves inside us all. One is evil. It is anger, envy, jealousy, sorrow, regret, greed, arrogance, self-pity, guilt, resentment, inferiority, lies, false pride, superiority, and ego." Quite a gathering there, wouldn't you say? "The other is good. It is joy, peace, love, hope, serenity, humility, kindness, benevolence, empathy, generosity, truth, compassion, and faith." The grandson thought about it for a minute and then asked his grandfather, "Which wolf wins?" The old grandfather simply replied, "The one you feed." That's a really good example of the real imperative to continue to cultivate both the wisdom and the compassion. Because really, when we let our minds and hearts run amok, I'm thinking you can imagine which one is being fed. And it becomes that automatic. Cultivating the good brings forth the opportunity to remember and recover the power of love. Harriet Tubman, who was the founder, creator, doer of the Underground Railroad, got busy. She got busy bringing slaves out of the South, and I'm sure that it took a big heart and many connections from many people to do that. She didn't dilly her time, energy, and effort hating or being angry at slave owners and all manner of oppressive conditions. She got to work. And there's many examples of that in terms of when we think about the public leaders. There's many leaders in our communities who are cultivating and causing change. But the public ones that we know about, when you think about them, Nelson Mandela, Elie Wiesel, Mother Teresa, all of them, you know, they can't exist at the same time for that magnitude and that degree of being an agent for change. Only love can exist in the heart. That doesn't happen from hate. That doesn't happen from anger, you know. So it's not that even in our lives, you know, wherever it is that we're engaged with bringing balance and harmony, goodwill and well-being, you know, it doesn't have to be on just that big public arena, within our families, within our communities, for some of us within the places we work, especially, you know, if you're in human service or you're a teacher, you know, if you're somebody that's engaged with people, there's always an opportunity to bring love present, even in the face of difficulty and challenge. It actually takes a lot less from us to meet chaos, stress, and difficulty with a heart wide open than with a contracted mind and a contracted heart around anger, irritation, disillusionment. This power of love is present as a potential in all of us. Even with all the suffering that comes from difficult experiences, it is easier, you know, us human beings, you know, particularly here, we are really conditioned towards the easy way out. So even with all the suffering that comes from difficult experience, it's still easier to live forward in a trauma trance than it is to break it down and deconstruct it before building anew with clear vision and love. It takes courage, intention, and commitment to live from this place of an integrated mind-heart. Many of us, though, are so armored and disconnected from the realization of who we really are that the false refuges of anger, frustration, seem to override our innermost knowing of what we know to be true. This practice of loving kindness is a pathway into the freedom and peace we really can come to know in this present day, in this embodied lived experience of being human. So it's not something way out there. It's not something that's not attainable. You know, and we have evidence of that as we look around at those who are living lives full out, engaged with being a contribution to themselves and to others. It is then from this very platform that our choices to decisions and actions become more steadied, effective, and efficient, perhaps even bringing along some ease. Another way to perceive metta is energetic understanding, more like goodwill than loving kindness. Sometimes that can be convoluted for people. Tenisaro Bhikkhu spoke of his teacher, Ajahn Fung. Ajahn Fung, my teacher, once discovered that a snake had moved into his room. Every time he entered the room, he saw it slip into a narrow space behind a storage cabinet. And even though he tried leaving the door to the room open during the daytime, the snake wasn't willing to leave. So for 3 days, they lived together. He was very careful not to startle the snake or make it feel threatened by his presence. But finally, on the evening of the third day, as he was sitting in meditation, he addressed the snake quietly in his mind. He said, "Look, it's not that I don't like you. I don't have any bad feelings for you. But our minds work in different ways. It'd be very easy for there to be a misunderstanding between us. Now, there are a lot of places out in the woods where you can live without the uneasiness of living with me." And as he sat there, spreading thoughts of metta to the snake left. Now, I was teaching at Vallecitos. That's one of the residential retreat centers. Was it last year? Yeah, I think it was last year. And Vallecitos is very much in the middle of nature. And it's beautiful, but it's a little rough, you know, for this city girl. So I'm at Vallecitos, and the first couple of nights I'm in my room, it's the middle of the night, and I hear all the mice scampering around. I'm like, oh, can they climb the sheets? Can they get it? You know, so I'm like fear, you know, anxiety, fear. But, you know, I worked with myself and I managed things and I started sending metta and we existed okay for a couple of days. And then I think it was the third or fourth day in, I woke up and I had to close the curtains in the room that I was staying in because the meditation hall was right across the way and people could look in. And I started walking towards the curtains and I looked down and there was this big ass snake. It was probably there all night, but I was asleep. And I had to do it, like, I didn't really see that, did I? And then it started moving, you know, snakes move. And I could feel the, I knew it wasn't all my fear, you know, that it was like a collective fear because snakes are given a bad rap in our culture. And I didn't know what to do. And, but I knew I couldn't, I knew I didn't have the capacity in that moment to move that snake out of there. I also knew that I didn't want it to do any harm to me or me to do any harm to it. I had no idea whether it was a poisonous snake or not. And so fortunately, I had a Sangha sister that was in a room upstairs, Sebane Selassie, who some of you may have heard her name, and if you haven't, I'm sure and hope that you do sometime over the coming years. And I go to the bottom of Sebane, there's a snake in my room. Can you help me out? I'm afraid. She said, well, I'm afraid too. But being the wonderful Sangha sister that she was, she came downstairs and she got the broom. And she's like guiding this snake out. She's like, get the door. And I opened the door and Mr. Snake just sidled on out. So I have a particular affinity for the story I just told you that it does happen. It's not just in the Dharma old-fashioned stories. Like, I woke up with a snake in my room. Who would have thought that? I don't know. Some of y'all here in Seattle are probably hikers and all up in the mountains and stuff. And it's not a big thing, but it was a big thing. So this attitude of goodwill, wishing the other person well, but realizing that true happiness really is something that each of us ultimately have to find and create and cultivate for ourselves. And that sometimes, most easily, it's better to go our separate ways when there's the possibility or potentiality of harm. And we, even on that level where some of us, you know, have been through life where we've had the experience of being in relationships way past the time when we should have been there, you know, where it's time to cut a job loose where it no longer supports us in our well-being. So it's not just these kind of extreme cases, but just looking to see how you're living in a day-to-day way. This attitude of goodwill, let me see, where was I? So metta, as the quality of goodwill, is useful for two reasons. The first is that goodwill is an attitude you can express for everyone without fear of being hypocritical or unrealistic. So there are those moments, those times, those places, those people where it really doesn't feel genuine to wish loving kindness. Like, it's just really not sitting right in the heart. But for the most part, I think at any point we can move ourselves towards wishing goodwill towards those that maybe are not aligning with well-being and goodness. It recognizes that people will become truly happy, not as a result of my caring or your caring for them, but as a result of their own skillful actions, and that the happiness of self-reliance is greater than any happiness that comes from dependency. The second reason is that goodwill is a more skillful feeling to have toward those who would react unskillfully to my exertion or your exertion of loving kindness. There are probably people that you've harmed, that I've harmed in the past, who would rather not have anything to do with me ever again. So the intimacy of loving kindness could actually be a source of pain for them rather than joy. But wishing them goodwill or offering them our goodwill could really support an energetic healing there. There are also people who, when they see that we want to express loving kindness, would be quick to take advantage of it. And of course, there are plenty of animals out there who would feel threatened by any overt expressions of love from human beings. In these cases, the more distant sense of goodwill, and it's not that it's distant, like way off, but it creates some space between the being and the self. That we'd promise ourselves never to harm those people or those beings. That would be better for everyone involved. This doesn't mean that loving kindness is never an appropriate expression of goodwill. We simply have to know when it's appropriate and when it's not. If you truly feel metta for yourself and others, you can't let your desire for warm feelings of intimacy and love render you insensitive to what actually would be the most skillful way to promote true happiness. So in wrapping up and coming to an end, I'm going to read one or two Dharma suttas. Some of them are from the Majjhima Nikaya, some of them are from the Anaka Nikaya. The verses here carry a similar sentiment. Be devoted to cultivating and protecting your goodwill to make sure that your virtuous intentions don't waver. This is because you don't want to harm anyone. Harm can happen most easily. Harm can happen most easily when there's a lapse in your goodwill. So you do whatever you can to protect this attitude at all times. This is why, as the Buddha says towards the end of the sutta, you should stay determined to practice this form of mindfulness, the mindfulness of keeping in mind your wish that all beings be happy, that all beings be well, to make sure that it always informs the motivation for everything you do. And this applies to oneself as well. This is why the Buddha explicitly recommends developing thoughts of metta in two situations where it's especially important and especially difficult: to maintain skillful motivation when others are hurting you, and when you realize that you've hurt others. If others are harming you with their words or actions, even if bandits were to carve you up savagely, limb by limb, with a two-handled saw, the Buddha recommends training your mind in this way. Our minds will be unaffected, and we will say no evil words. We will remain sympathetic with a mind of goodwill and with no inner hate. We will keep pervading these people with an awareness imbued with goodwill. And beginning with them, we will keep pervading the all-encompassing world with an awareness imbued with goodwill. In doing this, the Buddha says, you make your mind as expansive as the river Ganges or as large as the earth. In other words, larger than the harm those people are doing or threatening to do to you. I imagine that at least for in recent history, my ancestors, one of the reasons why there is such resilience and such capability to move onward and beyond the terrorism and oppression that visited was this aspect of not joining, not meeting that energy with hate. You know, Nelson Mandela spoke to that in terms of the many, many, many years that he spent on Robben Island, that he actually befriended his guards. He came to understand them, to speak their language, and it was through that that he was able to not just survive, but to actually re-engage and reorient his thinking about what would be the most helpful, the most useful in terms of creating conditions for freedom and dismantling apartheid. A similar thing happened, I think, in, you know, my speaking speaks to the fact of a particular generation that I'm from. But it was a similar thing with Malcolm X, you know, where he, through his, the development and the transformation of his heart and mind and understanding of things, came to understand that meeting oppression and aggression with violence, even if not actual violence, but an attitude of violence, actually would just perpetuate the same kind of energy. So taking a look to see on a small scale or a large scale where that kind of dynamic may be operating in your space. Right now, in this culture, it's all up for grabs. Differences, genderism, racism, homophobia, it's all up. You know, and we're at a choice point where we get to decide and choose what we're going to cultivate no matter what's happening out there. And you actually really have a lot more energy and a lot more of an ability to engage with cultivating and keeping yourself well, as well as contributing to the well-being of others, when you come from a place not of ignoring or not addressing what's not correct, but from a place of understanding of how greed, aversion, and delusion operate in the world, and that there are many people who are not awake. All right, so as a last statement, I think I'll just say that this metta practice opens the heart to accept the present moment, no matter how difficult it may be, and balances the often sobering wisdom gained through mindfulness. Because when you get those insights about what's really happening, you need some heart sometimes to just be with that. So let's just sit for a moment. Thank you for your listening.